Hi, I'm Karen Given, executive producer of Only a Game. We're in the midst of NPR's year-end digital fundraising campaign. So let's talk a little about what's at stake here. First and foremost, by contributing to your local station, you help make Only a Game possible. You help us pay for our staff, our freelance reporters, our studio time, our editing software, not to mention paying for a middle school French teacher slash actor to give us an amazing dramatic reading. Keep listening. And trust me, it's going to be great. That alone should be enough to encourage you to go to donate.npr.org/game right now to make a donation to your local station. But wait, there's more, because you'll also be helping your local station bring you the news. And as much as we all enjoy taking a break to talk about sports, the news is really important too. And there's one more thing. Only a Game is right now in competition with other NPR shows and podcasts to see who can raise the most money. And if we win, we get a trophy. And you know how much we love trophies. So we're asking right now, as long as you're not driving, and if you're driving, you should totally wait until later, for you to pause this podcast and go to donate.npr.org/game to make a donation to your local station. And thanks. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. The idea came to him in the winter of 2017. Anton Gunnison was rereading a book he'd read twice before. The book follows four teams in 1907 as they race nearly 10,000 miles from Peking to Paris. But five teams had actually started that event.
There wasn't much written about the fifth competitor, which was Auguste Pons. They sort of left him out in this story. And I thought, like, why did Auguste Pons did not get his place in history? Well, it's clear, because he didn't make it.
And so, as Anton was reading this book for the third time, he had an idea.
What if we finish what this guy started?
In a sense, Anton knew what he was getting himself into. The Peking to Paris was brought back in 1997 as an endurance rally for classic and vintage cars. It's a point-to-point over 36 days. All the competitors stop at the same hotel or campsite every night. Anton and his wife completed the rally 6 years ago in the relative comfort of their 1950 Bentley. But to finish what Auguste Pons had started, Anton would need to complete the journey in a 1906 Kontal Mototri. It's basically a motorcycle on three wheels, two in the front, one in the back. The co-driver, or navigator, sits between the front wheels in a seat so dangerous, the Kontal factory gave it a special name.
Le tu belle-mère, which means the kill your mother-in-law seat.
The Peking to Paris is held every 3 years. And by the time Anton got up the courage to email the race director to ask for an entry, the rally was already full.
But since I had a proposal that had never been done before, I was sort of hoping that he would say yes.
The race director got back to Anton a few days later.
And he said, you're mad.
But he accepted Anton's entry anyway.
So there was no way back from that moment, I think.
The automobile was just over two decades old when the first Peking to Paris race was announced.
Well, it was a newspaper called Le Matin in France in January 1907.
That's Tony Jardine. He's the communications director with Hero ERA, the company that puts on the modern Peking to Paris rally.
And essentially what they were doing was challenging the automakers of the time to show that modern cars were more than just a novelty for the rich, really.
40 teams entered, but only five actually made it to the starting line in China.
No roads, no maps, uncharted territory.
The route followed telegraph poles all the way from China through Mongolia and Russia.
So what they decided to do was dispatch mules and camels with fuel into strategic spots where they could pick up their gas along the route.
Without any real roads to rely on, Pons hoped he and his co-driver, Oscar Foucault, could just pick up their tiny trike and carry it over obstacles. Still, with just 9 horsepower, the Kontal was very slow.
He was the slowest one, But at the same time, I think he was the bravest one. And certainly Oscar, his co-driver, was very, very brave indeed, because, you know, if you hit any bumps, you went over, you would just get ejected straight off the front of it. But I don't think they got that far to find out.
If Anton Gunnison was to have any chance of finishing what Pons started, Anton first needed to get his hands on a 1906 Kontal Mototri.
I thought in the beginning that I would find one, but it appeared to be extremely difficult, and now I know there must be about 4, 5, or 6 left in the world.
Where they are is anyone's guess. Private collectors tend not to advertise vehicles they have no intention of ever selling, which sent Anton on to plan B.
I got a tip, and they said they have one in the storage of the Le Mans 24 Hours Museum. I made an appointment, I spoke to a lot of people, and then I got in. And this was actually quite an important moment, because we were allowed to take all the dimensions, we could measure it up, We took a million pictures.
And did seeing it make you have any second thoughts? Because I think if I was standing in front of something like that and saw how small and not comfortable it was, I would start thinking, maybe I shouldn't do this.
Funny you ask. Everybody I spoke about this project, they told me to stop it, not to do it. It was impossible. I would hurt myself. It couldn't be done. There was a reason Pons didn't make it. And actually, they were all right. And as the project evolved, I understood more and more what I had to do to get it done.
Since Anton couldn't find an original 1906 Kontal Mototri, he built one using the specifications he had gathered. And like Pons had 112 years earlier, Anton made some improvements. He strengthened the chassis. He put on sturdier wheels.
It also had an engine, 45 horsepower instead of the 9 horsepower that Pons had. But then again, I needed those horsepowers to make it from Peking to Paris on the time that the rally gave me.
While the 1907 competitors could take as long as they needed to get to the next refueling station, Anton would need to make it to the rally stop every night. But manufacturing a vehicle from scratch took a lot longer than Anton had planned for, and he received his finished 1906 model Kontal Mototri with time to do just 150 kilometers, roughly 90 miles of road testing.
I thought that it was a mistake. But still, as I always say, half the rally is getting to the start.
And so, on June 2nd, 2019, Anton Gunnison and his co-driver Herman Galun lined up at the Great Wall of China near Beijing.
It was raining a little bit, like this drizzle. It doesn't make you happy. It drizzles. It's a bit burr. The flag goes down. You start. People clap. You hear the photographers clickety-clickety away. The mass of people goes open like the Red Sea. You drive through it, and 1 minute later, you're totally alone. There's nobody cheering anymore. There's silence, there's the engine, and you know you're going to be there for 36 days with a lot of trouble. So it feels amazingly alone when it actually happens, when you drive away.
But when August Pons drove away from the start in 1907, he felt anything but alone.
We left Peking on June 10 with a heart full of hope.
That's an actor reading from an account of the race written by August Pons in August 1907.
All the drivers had a friendship that one might have thought sincere.
He knew that they would probably be last.
This is Tony Jardine again.
And yet, in the month that they all spent together in the Hotel Peking, making all their preparations, they all got on extremely well, and they all made these vows and these promises together that each would help the other out.
But just a week into the race, it all started to go wrong.
It was the 18th of June that began what I can call, without exaggeration, my ordeal.
Pons had got lost from the telegraph poles, and he'd wavered off over to the left because the track was quite good over on that side.
I continue without worry, thinking to find the telegraph poles a little further. After half an hour, no more tracks on the ground, and we had not encountered any path. I was getting very worried, because the gas that I had did not allow me to make an extra trip.
Then he was very lucky to come across, you know, some Mongolian riders. They'd seen four other vehicles, so they pointed out a shortcut for him to get across this grassy section, I don't know, 10, 12 kilometres, and he managed to catch up with the other four vehicles before, you know, he finally got lost again.
The situation became agonising. Wanting to preserve the petrol that remained to me, I decided to stop next to a camp of Chinese who gave us water.
And by this time, they were already very thirsty, very hungry.
The Chinese water was terrible. It was mud. But with what delight we drank it.
They felt sure that the others, after this time, you know, a day and a half or so, would be looking for them. So they took turns of sleeping and on lookout.
The next morning, Pons and Foucault scanned the horizon, looking for other drivers.
Nothing.
Nothing.
The pair drove on for a few kilometers before their fuel tank ran dry and they were forced to continue on foot to the next stop.
Then they marched for something like 6 kilometers, believing it was just over the horizon. It wasn't. They're in a real state. They decide to go back to the motorcycle.
Stunned by the sun, stupefied by fatigue, tormented by thirst and anger, we arrive at 7 o'clock in the evening at our motorcycle. Without eating, without drinking, we fall asleep with hope again, but the hope that weakened more and more. On the morning of the 20th, nothing. Still nothing.
August Pond's race would end at that spot in Mongolia. 112 years later, Anton Gunnison hadn't even made it out of China when his trouble began.
After the first day, I looked at the console and I said, oh, there's something strange with those front wheels. But anyway, we'll see tomorrow.
The next day, when Anton and Herman stopped for fuel, they noticed the front wheels, which were supposed to be straight, cambered in by 10 degrees. The axle had bent almost to the point of failure.
I showed it to the guy in the petrol station, and he pointed out to a village that was 3 kilometers further, and I understood that he said, ask there.
Anton found the welder and, pointing again at his crooked front wheels, asked him to insert a metal pipe inside the axle to straighten it and make it stronger.
The axle went away with a guy on a small motorcycle. Brrp. 2 hours later, it came back. It was all straight again. Problem solved.
Problem solved. But you still had a lot of worries in your brain, a lot of visualizations of what could go wrong if this broke again, right?
Something went wrong in my head. So I started to imagine that this axle was going to break while I was on the highway following a truck or with a truck behind me. I mean, I have a very imaginative mind. And then I saw Herman projected out of the seat on the tarmac. And I thought, Jesus Christ, this guy is going to die. So I became a lot more cautious, perhaps too cautious.
Did you tell Herman that you were having these thoughts?
Nope. Wouldn't have been smart, I think.
So Anton kept his worries to himself as he and Herman climbed aboard the Kontal for day 3, the day they would pass that spot in the desert where Pons ran out of fuel.
That was an important day, the third day. Everybody started complimenting us and yes, you're well done and you're further than Pons, at least you have this. But I wasn't satisfied with that result. I didn't come there to get a bit further. I wanted to get to Paris, of course.
By the third day of his ordeal, August Pons had lost all hope of continuing on to Paris as part of the race. But he still had to find a way out of the Gobi Desert. Pons believed the other drivers must have turned around to rescue them by now, but with no signs of help on its way, he and Foucault set out again on foot.
Suddenly, I utter an exclamation of joy. What is it? Foucault asks me. Look over there, over there. Do you see these tents?
And it was Mongolian tribesmen, and they were saved yet again.
The tribesmen brought oxen to pull the Moto Tri to the safety of their camp. But Pons couldn't let go of the fact that it was locals and not his fellow drivers who had saved him.
And I think Karen, you read one of the reports that I read when he said, you know, that my house, you know, meaning his whole family house, had put so much into this.
And all this is destroyed by the lack of comradeship of my companions of the road.
He tried all the options to try and, you know, get the motor tri out of there. But he had to leave all the spare parts. He had to leave the trike.
Pons and Foucault eventually made it back home, riding with a caravan of camels part of the way. When Pons' account was printed in a French magazine 2 months later, in late August 1907, Prince Scipione Borghese had already arrived in Paris, 3 weeks ahead of the second-place finisher. Nobody ever went back for Auguste Pons and Oscar Foucault.
But it is already old history. We cheer for those who finished the race. And I have already been forgotten.
On day three of the 2019 rally, Anton Gunnison had made it further than Pons ever had. But he was still in Mongolia, and he had yet to face his biggest challenge. Let's skip ahead to day seven. What happened with your axle then?
We drove into the campsite, and I saw people looking at my wheels.
Anton already knew something was going on with his wheels. He'd been staring at them all day. But just as he and Herman pulled into the campsite, the axle broke completely. The only thing holding the trike together was the pipe that had been inserted into the axle on day two.
Again, for the second time, I was sure, nearly sure, that the rally was finished. So I was a bit heartbroken for 10 minutes.
The repair took 4 or 5 hours, but eventually a Mongolian welder was able to use a rusted piece of scrap metal to fortify the axle.
At that moment, I sort of realized that probably we were going to make it.
I don't want to say that the rest of the journey was easy. In fact, it was miserable. By the end, Anton Gunnison could no longer feel two fingers on each hand. They had gone numb from the vibrations coming up the handlebars. But he and Herman passed through Mongolia, then Russia, Kazakhstan, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Poland, and into Germany.
Once in Germany, you know you're there. You know you're there. Nothing is going to go wrong there. And even if it does, you can fix it.
So take me to the end of the rally. How did it feel to actually legitimately finish this thing that Pons had started?
That's a good question. I didn't feel anything. So when I arrived in Paris, I thought that the world would be too small and that explosions would happen in my head and that I would dance on this amazing, beautiful square. I didn't. I was just extremely happy that it stopped, that it was done. It only came to me a week or so after, slowly, in bits and pieces. I really think, it sounds silly, but 1907, five teams set out to do something incredible. Four of them arrive, one gets stuck in the Gobi Desert, goes back home, nobody talks about him anymore, he gets forgotten, finished. I pick it up 112 years later. I think that the gold medal is his, or at least his and mine. So what I will do, go back to Paris and put the medal on his grave, making it a happy ending.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Fans, please welcome back Kawhi!
On Wednesday night, Kawhi Leonard returned to Toronto for the first time since he led the Raptors to an NBA championship. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Mike Pesca, the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and by The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Michael, you're up.
NBA reunions are often pretty ugly. We've seen it in this last decade. LeBron go back to Cleveland the first time and get booed incessantly. We've seen Kevin Durant go back to Oklahoma City and get called a cupcake and a snake and everything else that his mother didn't name him. But when Kawhi Leonard returned to Toronto, we got the opposite spectrum. We got a chance for a community, a city, a country to show their love and respect for a player who gave their franchise credibility and validation by winning a championship. It was the greatest one-and-done story in NBA history, a player who was traded to a place that he didn't necessarily want to go, but made the best of it, and it turned out to be a gratifying, steamy affair. Kawhi returned, they chanted his name, MVP, they had a great tribute video, and I just kind of want to get your thoughts on just if winning does cure any type of ill will or if it just happened to be a fluky situation.
Maybe being Canadian cures a lot of ill will. I mean, there was a confluence of factors, right?
Yeah.
Canadians are nice. They won their championship. Everyone pretty much realized that the Kawhi tenure was a rental and, you know, what a great 5-star review on Airbnb for that. And then you have the other factor that the Raptors, post-Kawhi, people were slotting them in as a non-playoff team. They're doing great. They've had players who are role players like Van Vliet and Pascal Siakam really flourish. So all the factors that could have gone wrong have gone very well for the city to properly show Kawhi the love and for that love to register on Kawhi's face as a totally blank expression because that's what Kawhi does.
I don't know if you guys saw this, but there were these competing billboards, which I really love. So New Balance and Kawhi put up a huge thank you Toronto in, I guess Toronto has like sort of a mini version of Times Square. I didn't know that. I apparently need to go to Toronto.
You do.
I've never been. And the Raptors return the favor with billboards at Scotiabank Arena and BMO Field. Clippers coach Doc Rivers said the whole thing was super classy. And Michael, I want to compare that to the reception Paul George got on Monday, 2 years after he left Indiana. This is, I guess, his third time back in town. There were boos. There were chants I can't say on the radio. And I know it's not just that everybody's nicer up in Canada. So what's going on in Indiana?
Well, I do want to offer one correction. They are nice in Canada, but they're not that nice. And if you ask Vince Carter what he had to endure the 10 years after he demanded a trade out of Toronto, he'll let you know that they were not very friendly with him, and they didn't forgive him until he was no longer a threat to the success of their franchise, and they started winning again. But as for Paul George, he sort of understands that that's just what he's going to deal with when he goes there. And I actually had this chance to speak to him about the reception that Kawhi got and the reception that he got. And I said, so I guess the championship is the difference. And he said, not exactly, because Kawhi Leonard does go back to San Antonio. And he does not get the same love that he gets in Toronto, even though he was the finals MVP with the Spurs in 2014. And Paul George basically said that when things don't go the way they want them to, fans look at us as the bad guys. And, you know, it's unusual when you have a breakup that it is a positive breakup. But I think what happened with Kawhi, too, is that it was such a short, you know, it's almost like that summer fling that you have or, you know, when you're young. And that's sort of what happened with Kawhi and the Raptors. It was just that fun summer experience that you could just always hold on to.
Okay, so on Monday, the World Anti-Doping Agency banned Russia from all major sports events for the next 4 years. We all remember back to last winter's Olympics. Russian athletes who could prove they were clean were allowed to compete, but not under their team name or flag, and they didn't hear their national anthem when they won. That ban stemmed from the state-sponsored cover-up of doping at the 2014 Sochi Games. So the Russian Olympic team was reinstated last year, but as a condition of that reinstatement, they were required to provide WADA with a full copy of the data from their lab. Instead, they allegedly planted fake evidence and deleted files, and that brings us to this latest four-year ban. And this thing has gone all crazy political, as is the way in 2019. A narrative is emerging in Russia that suggests that this ban is part of the West trying to hold Russia back back. And normally I would be all yada, 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 same old about this, but Russian boxers have apparently voted unanimously to reject the idea of competing as neutral athletes again. They're planning to boycott. They say, we didn't cheat. We run a clean sport. Why should we be punished? And I don't know, maybe they have a point. Mike, what do you think?
Well, the Russian Federation has been having a systemic doping program for years now. And as much as you don't want a federation to have doped and these athletes to have cheated, but if it has happened, I do want a full and real ban on these athletes. And yeah, even some quote unquote innocent athletes, especially because they are given an out of participating under the Olympic flag. If they say, no, we choose to stand by the flag of Russia, well, then you can't compete. And that, I think, is a fair thing.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with what he just said. I mean, there are going to be casualties of this if you have a government, you know, that is, you know, promoting cheating and encouraging it. And I just feel like if that's what they want to, you know, say that we won't compete if we can't represent our flag, then I say sorry, because your flag represents something that the Olympics is not for, which is doping and cheating.
Yeah. It almost seems like they think, oh, if we say we're not going to compete, then WADA's going to back down and we're going to be allowed to compete under our flag. But I really think that history is not on their side on that one.
Yeah. And can I just add one more thing?
Yeah.
This ban is not just for the benefit of the other clean athletes. You know, Russian athletes are compelled to dope. And so if there were a robust punishment regimen in place, then perhaps these very athletes, at least future generations of Russian athletes, won't feel pressured or made to do this to their bodies.
Really well said. All right, Mike, what do you have?
Well, we have Spygate 2, or maybe 2.something. The details this time around are that a crew from the New England Patriots showed up, they were credentialed, at a Browns-Bengals game. Why? Because the crew was doing a series, they say, for the Patriots website. This week's vignette was to be the advanced scouts, but during the entire second quarter, a Patriots videographer was just had his camera trained on the opposite sidelines. The cameraman identified himself as a Robert Kraft employee and asked if he could just delete the footage and it will all be forgotten. I'm surprised he didn't like pull out 100 and said Benjamin Franklin can make this all go away. And if you remember back to the original Spygate, where from 2000 to 2007 they were demonstrated to have been taping opponent sidelines, here is what Matt Walsh, a former Patriots videographer, told the NFL, as reported by ESPN. During games, the Patriots videographers were told to look like media members, to tape over their team logos or turn their sweatshirts inside out, to wear credentials that said Patriot TV or Kraft Productions. So the whole identifying yourself, that raises another red flag, as does the fact that these are New England Patriots employees videotaping the other team.
All right, Michael, I know you have no love for the Patriots, so bring it on.
You probably won't find a bigger Patriots hater than this man right here. And I love whenever they get caught cheating, because that's what they do. Cheaters cheat and they can't stop cheating. But I'm kind of willing to give them a pass on this one, because I think this is actually some bumbling videographer who maybe overstepped his bounds. I mean, the fact that he was, I think he was reportedly in Boston Bruins hockey gear.
Yeah.
Already made the first mistake there. And also, we're talking about the Bengals. I mean, I know that, you know, Tom Brady's had a rough couple of weeks and he, you know, he's lost, you know, back-to-back games or whatever. But if they got to do this with the Bengals, then something's really wrong over in Belichick land. So I'm giving them a pass on this one.
Wow. I did not expect you to give the Patriots a pass ever.
I know. Ever. That's not something I do, because I usually like to just jump on them, and especially when they get caught doing something dirty. If it was the Ravens or somebody, I'm like, oh, they definitely did it. They don't even need to scout the Bengals. They could just show up and beat them.
Unlike you, Michael, I am a Patriots fan.
I know.
And I enjoy going to games. I think Brady is the GOAT. I miss Gronk. I believe in my heart of hearts that those footballs were not deflated. It was just really cold outside that night. That said, guys, do better. Like, you've been caught illegally filming before. You need to know that when you get caught filming again and you say, I was filming a documentary, it's totally, totally, totally going to sound like a lie. And then the fact that the documentary is called Do Your Job just kills me, because if everyone was doing their job, they would have gotten the proper approval to film for the documentary, and they wouldn't have filmed anything they shouldn't have. Mike, what's a Pats fan to do with all of this?
Well, I guess you could still compete under the Russian flag, right? Against the Bengals. it's a very New England, it's a very Boston scandal, because I love the idea, as Michael points out, the guy shows up in a Bruins shirt, like essentially just wearing like almost a Dunkin' Donuts hat, saying, can you direct me to the bubbler and the Mass Pike? No ma! I'm like, how much more Boston can he be?
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, I promise to keep this quick, but this is the part of the show where I remind you that you can get Only a Game via podcast. Please subscribe and please leave us a review. It helps other listeners find the show. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game is produced in Boston with help from listeners like you. Why not make a donation today? Just go to donate.npr.org/game to donate to your local station. And thanks. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, George Archer, the championship golfer who couldn't read. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The Yankees spent 11 years trying to woo pitcher Gerrit Cole to New York. They finally got him with a 9-year, $324 million contract, making Cole the highest paid pitcher in Major League history. What do you make of that price tag?
Well, the first thing I know is the first time he has a bad game, he's going to love the back pages of the New York tabloids. Secondly, there's no way they're going to pay him the last 2 or 3 years of that contract.
Yeah.
Gerrit Cole is not a young man. If they can get out of him what they've got of, say, CeCe Sabathia, they're very, very lucky.
Third baseman Anthony Rendon is headed to the Angels for 7 years, $245 million. And Steven Strasburg is staying with the Nationals also for 7 years, $245 million. Scott Boras is the agent for Cole, Rendon, and Strasburg. The combined value of those contracts is $814 million. Not a bad week for Boras, eh?
It's the most wonderful time of the year. What can I tell you? He's good at his job. Everybody knows that about Scott Boras. The Nationals thing is interesting, of course, because while Strasburg is probably their signature player, he was the first real star they drafted, and he's now played all the way through their world championship. Rendon, of course, got a great late season and postseason, as did all the Nationals, and now he's getting paid. So good for him.
Remember last year when there were no signings of note during the winter meetings and this whole thing dragged on and on and on and people were using words like collusion? What happened?
I think they decided not to collude. There's no question in my mind that there was collusion going on last year. But I think it was so blatantly obvious that they decided to play it fairly straight this time around.
Under a new agreement with the union, MLB will begin testing for opioids and cocaine, but only players who don't comply with treatment plans will be disciplined, and marijuana will no longer be listed as a drug of abuse and instead treated the same as alcohol. Is it just me, or is this new policy shockingly reasonable?
It's incredibly reasonable. I did not know that they hadn't been testing for cocaine.
Right.
I mean, cocaine was the original drug frenzy. Right. In Major League Baseball, you know, back in the late 70s and early 80s. So, I mean, that was a surprise to me. I think treating marijuana like alcohol is eminently reasonable, of course. And I think, you know, allowing players to go to treatment and then conditioning their punishment on what they do after they get out is a remarkable spasm of good sense on the part of Major League Baseball.
Shocking. Marvin Miller, the union leader who brought free agency and arbitration to baseball, has finally been elected into the Hall of Fame. I know you have a let them all in policy when it comes to Halls of Fame, but how do you feel about Miller's upcoming induction?
That it's about 15 or 20 years too late. I mean, that the fact that he wasn't inducted while he was alive was an act of pure vengeance on the part of Major League Baseball and, unfortunately, too many people in my business, Marvin Miller is without question one of the two or three most influential people in the history of American sports, and probably one of the five or six greatest labor leaders in American history, period. So, yes, he should have been inducted while he was alive, although the odds are pretty good that he would have declined the invitation.
Well, as you say, before his death in 2012, Miller actually asked that his name be removed from consideration, calling the whole process a farce. So why now?
Well, because I think they can get away with it. And it was such a conspicuous omission that, you know, even Major League Baseball noticed.
This week, USA Today published a year-long investigation into how the NCAA deals with athletes charged with sexual misconduct. And the simple answer is, it doesn't. There's no NCAA rule against committing sexual or violent crimes. This from the same organization that once ruled that you could give an athlete a bagel, but not cream cheese.
To be entirely fair to the NCAA, and you know how hard it is for me to say that.
I do.
It's really hard for it to be a law enforcement organization. It's not very good at it. It doesn't enforce its own rules very well, let alone the law. You know, right now, you're seeing rollbacks at the federal level of Title IX enforcement procedures against universities that ignore this problem. It's really up to the federal government and to the institutions to get their act back together and start taking this as seriously as it once did. If you're looking for a villain in this, don't look at the NCAA. Look at Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos.
And finally, Charlie, Fantasy Premier League has more than 7 million players worldwide. And as we speak, the man currently sitting in fourth place in that league is a man known to fans of another sport or game, depending on your definition. And that man would be?
That man would be Magnus Carlsen, a chess grandmaster. I think multidisciplinary athletes are a great thing. I'm really waiting for Carlsen's next move, which I predict, Karen, will be Garoppolo to Belichick's knight level 5.
You realize you're talking about the wrong kind of football, right?
I do, yes.
Okay, good. Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Our next story is about a guy who is amazing. But don't take it from me. Take it from Ellen.
I can't believe you're a professional football player and then you do this. You're amazing.
You know what? It's a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
His name is John Dornbos. He played in the NFL from 2003 to 2016, and he might be even more impressive as a magician.
I tell you what, there's one, there's two, there's three, and then there's all four threes for you. I thought we'd bust them all out. No, hold on.
John Dornbos is known for his upbeat, positive energy in front of the camera, but he came to both football and magic through tragedy. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has this story.
When 12-year-old John Dornbos woke up for baseball camp on the morning of August 3, 1992, two things were unusual. First, all his gear was out on the table, not where it normally was in the garage. And also, his dad was there, but not his mom.
I said, hey, where's mom?
John's dad said she'd gone swimming.
And I didn't think anything of it. And I, at 12 years old, I don't think you read too much into stuff like that.
John got a ride from some friends. Later on, while he was at camp, his coach approached him.
Yeah, he kind of came over ghost face and said, hey, John, your friends are here. They're going to pick you up. There'd been an accident and you got to go. And I said, okay, yeah, no problem.
John thought maybe his dad had got hurt playing soccer. There's no way he could have predicted what had really happened, because as far as he knew, he'd grown up in a happy family. John's dad was the president of his little league in Woodinville, Washington. They'd play catch every day. John remembers seeing his dad coming into the kitchen to find his mom.
He would grab her and sneak her away, and they would go into the pantry and close the door and turn the light off. And never once did I ever wonder what they were doing in there. And then I got older and I was like, oh my gosh, they were totally making out.
You're like, I mean, that is where they keep the cookies. So it makes sense.
Yeah, right. Totally.
So as John was driven from baseball camp to the police station, he was unprepared for what he was about to learn. And just a warning that what you're about to hear is disturbing.
They said your parents last night got in an argument and your mom was pushed down some steps and she didn't make it. And right now your dad is in jail and he's being held for questioning, and we're trying to get answers and figure out what happened. Wait, I'm sorry, what? Yeah, your parents got an argument, and your mom died. You don't really know how to react to that, right? So you're just sitting there, and you just get cold. And I couldn't tell you if I was in that room for 5 minutes, an hour, all day. I have no idea. And at that time, you know, I don't think there was a lot of information, and I think they didn't really know what to tell me. Mm-hmm. And the reality was my mom was not pushed. You know, my dad used a bench grinder and a sledgehammer, and it was bad. And it happened in the garage.
John's father had spent the previous night trying to clean up the evidence. But after John left for baseball camp, he turned himself into police.
I remember seeing, you know, my family's name on the front of the newspaper, turn on the TV, and it was all over the news. And I just remember being embarrassed. Mm. Like, I remember being embarrassed for my family name. And, you know, I would go to school, and I felt like there was a lot of times where people just didn't really know how to act around me.
John didn't know it then, but that concern for his family name would drive many of his decisions in the years to come. John's father was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 13 years and 8 months in prison. John was there throughout the trial.
I would sit outside and just started devouring my fingernails, and I had all this nervous energy. I mean, I would bite my nails to where they would bleed. I'd bite my nails to where when you'd look at my finger, it was like a stump, and like you'd just see like ratted up cuticles. They were disgusting.
Almost a year after the murder, John and his sister moved to Southern California to live with their aunt. John cut off contact with his dad. He wouldn't see him for another 26 years. Not long after the move, John returned to Washington for a Little League All-Star tournament. He stayed at his coach's house.
And the neighbor across the street was a 16-year-old magician. And so they said, hey, look, this kid's been through a lot. Like, maybe you can just come over and do like 30 minutes of magic and maybe it'll cheer him up. So sure enough, the kid comes over and it got me. You know, he lit a match and looked at it and the flame went like 10, 15 feet high. You know, he took a sponge ball. He put one sponge ball in my hand. He took one. It disappeared. And when I opened my hand, I had both of them. It was just this cool, cool world of like, how is this possible? It's magic. From that moment on, I was hooked. They took me to the magic shop in Seattle. They got me a book. They got me, you know, a couple tricks. Magic for me was my escape. It was my out. Magic for me was the one time that if I sat at a table and I was working on a trick, all the chatter and the evil of the world, it just quieted. And I felt like I was just a kid in that moment. I wasn't thinking about my dad going to prison. I wasn't thinking about my mom being killed. I wasn't thinking about moving and having to start new friends. The world just became a really cool place for me.
John got good quickly. Because he didn't want people noticing his chewed up fingernails, he developed a fast pace. In the eighth grade, he won his school's talent show. He then started at Pacifica High School in Garden Grove.
So I'm in high school, and my buddy comes out to me and says, hey, you know, you're a big kid, like you should play football. No way, man. Football's for dorks. I like magic. And then sure enough, he's like, but you can hit that guy and not get in trouble. Look, I had a lot of anger built up in me. I had a lot of questions and a lot of resentment. Yeah, let's give that a shot.
So John joined the football team. He played linebacker, and he loved that too.
And I had these two outlets, shuffle cards. I'd listen to track number 9 on repeat, Felista from Yanni, all night. And then during the day, I would play football, right? It was just this perfect balance.
Magic was John's escape. But sports gave John a sense of family and, he thought, a way to bring positive attention back to his family name.
When you play sports, you have your name on your back and the whole world can see it.
John could have pursued college baseball, but he was set on football because he wanted to be a rock star. He wanted to run out onto the field for a Division I team in front of 100,000 people. But there was a problem with this plan.
Look, here's the deal. I thought I was the greatest high school player ever. Clearly, obviously. Problem is, apparently not one college coach agreed with me. And so, no offers, no looks.
John says there were some good junior college teams that wanted him. But the one that got his attention was called Golden West in nearby Huntington Beach.
Golden West could barely field a team, and they were 0-30. They hadn't won a game in 3 years.
John thought of something a coach had told him.
All you got to do is get on the field, and they'll find you.
So John played for Golden West. They lost another 10 straight. but he was still set on playing Division I football.
So I asked the coaches for some game film, and I was going to put together my own highlight tape and send it out. And so I made my highlight tape, and it was good.
But John figured it would be even better if he worked some VCR magic and edited in a few plays from his Golden West teammate, who was a harder hitter.
You know, the film's a little grainy, and who could tell who's who?
John also edited in some clips from the team's long snapper. That's the guy who hikes the ball for punts and kicks. It's a highly skilled position that John had played in high school.
So now I got a highlight tape with a lot of my highlights, you know, a few of Nick's big hits, and then a few of Tim's really, really good snaps. So sure enough, I got a scholarship to be a long snapper.
John was headed to the Division I University of Texas at El Paso.
Figured out how to do it really, really quick, and I had a knack for it, but I had to fine-tune it.
Was any part of you scared that you would get discovered as a sort of fraud?
No, I was never scared I was going to get discovered because I truly didn't view myself as a fraud. You know? And I think that's kind of important to say because I knew I could do it. I had done it in high school, and I felt like I deserved to be there.
After three seasons at UTEP, John was considered a top NFL long snapping prospect. How do you think all the time you'd spent on magic helped you become a great long snapper?
Magic, actually, it got me obsessed with doing something over and over and over in search of the perfect rep, but loving that process. That's what magic's about, and that's what snapping's about. It's about taking something and just doing it 10,000 times, a million times until it's right.
John signed with the Buffalo Bills in 2003. From 2006 to 2016, he snapped for the Philadelphia Eagles. Twice he went to the Pro Bowl. And the whole time, John kept up the magic. He'd perform card tricks for his teammates in the locker room. Ahead of the 2016 NFL season, John auditioned for the TV show America's Got Talent. He didn't tell the Eagles. He figured he'd either drop out or be eliminated before it started to conflict with his day job. But during one of the early tapings, John got the golden buzzer. That meant he was fast-tracked to the show's later rounds. So as John got ready for Eagles training camp, a few episodes of the show had already aired, and he still hadn't had a conversation about it with the Eagles.
NBC thinks the Eagles just excused me from training camp. Now, meanwhile, the Eagles have no idea what's going on. And so I was like, oh gosh, here we go. I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, okay, I'm just going to show up to training camp and we'll see what they say.
When John arrived, Jeffrey Lurie, the team owner, and other Eagles higher-ups were there.
And they said, why didn't you tell us you're doing this? This is awesome.
They wanted John to keep competing on the show, even though the football season was starting. And they had some pretty persuasive logic.
They were like, look, magic's your life. And let's be honest, it's not like you're the quarterback. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're a long snapper.
Still, John wasn't going to shirk on his Eagles duties.
I would go to training camp at 8 in the morning. My day would end at about 5. And there was like a 6 or 6:30 flight to L.A., so I'd run to the airport and I would land, shoot some B-roll, do a rehearsal, hit a meeting, and then I'd go back to LAX and at 10:30, I would hit that red eye that would land at 7:15 in the morning. And then I would go right from the airport to my 8 o'clock meeting. And I would kind of repeat that cycle on any days necessary.
On September 11th, 2016, John started at long snapper in the Eagles' season opening win over the Browns. Then a few days later, he competed in the finale of America's Got Talent. He finished in third place. Looking back now, John calls it the coolest time of his life.
I never wanted to say no to anything. And so even if it was like, hey, John, do you think you can be in LA and just do this hour interview? Yeah, I'll be there. And I think it comes back to that sense of I wanted people to hear my name. I wanted people to say my name. And I wanted people to associate good things with it.
John Dorenbos last played in the NFL in 2016. In 2017, he married his wife, Annalise. Their daughter was born this year. John now regularly performs on the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And one last thing. A few years ago, John stopped biting his fingernails.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For much more on the life of John Dorenbos, including his recent conversation with his dad, check out his new book with Larry Platt, Life is Magic, My Inspiring Journey from Tragedy to Self-Discovery. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Additional help this week from Arlo Moore Bloom and our French actor, Ben Bayou. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.